You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Well, good morning, Alex.
Hey, good morning.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I keep getting you between sips of coffee.
Sorry. There we go. I should have been more ready.
Alex, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
For those who haven't come across you online, introduce yourself to our listeners and give them a glimpse of what we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, well, my name is Alex Evans, and I've been a pharmacist for about 10 years from North Carolina originally, so went to UNC. And after I graduated and spent about a year saving up some money, I moved to Hawaii, so I lived there for 5 years, three on the Big Island and two for Maui. And then moved back to the mainland. So I live in Jacksonville, Florida now. Got a couple things, one to kind of talk about. One is my medical writing course. I got into medical writing in 2016, really just as a hobby, and grew it into a business that's allowed me to go part-time practicing as a pharmacist, and still love being a pharmacist, but if I had to, I could be get to the point of medical writing full-time. In this current role that I'm in, started a project more recently to help community pharmacists understand compliance and operations better. So started farmcompliance.com, created some forms for download to help pharmacies just be able to quickly get paper forms they need. They might otherwise have to spend time that they don't have making themselves.
I like right off the bat that you say, you know, I'm writing and I could do this full time. Out of your week, what percent are you in pharmacy versus figuratively at least sitting at your desk typing away?
Even my current pharmacy job isn't exactly dispensing necessarily, but within that role, I'd say I still probably do that maybe 3/4 of the time, 2/3. I'm not sure, the majority of the time. And then I also pick up the writing with the remainder. And I love the job. And I've said it before on other podcasts, but I love being a community pharmacist too. But it's no secret where the industry has been heading with mail order and DIR fees and all of the pressures that we all know about. So it feels good either way to know that no matter what happens to that job or any job, you can your own business could sustain you, or you have this other job skill that could land you another type of job that is in high demand with salaries that are often similar, maybe sometimes a little bit lower to begin with, but similar to what you're currently making.
Did I read that you're a project manager? I love projects. When I was a kid, I always looked at the clock in the pharmacy and I always thought, well, if I could do a project, that's fun. Is that anything close, or am I way off base?
It kind of is, yeah. So I think my official job title is still pharmacist 1 or 2 or 3. I don't really know. It's something like that. But it doesn't really accurately describe what I do, just because Ascension Health, of course, being a large national organization, they have to keep the job standardized job titles. So he put me in a job title that's fitting, pharmacist. But essentially, I came on board in 2016 with Ascension and started out managing their outpatient pharmacy, but always had these fun little projects going on the side. And our staffing at the time was good. I understandably had an advantage there that the staffing model is different than it is at most community pharmacies. But I decided to take advantage of that time and just start going after all sorts of quality improvement, performance improvement, finance projects. So, for example, we did an initiative to improve opioid safety, and it was actually part of the health systems initiatives that actually caught the attention of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. But we tapped into that on the outpatient side by pushing to reduce the co-dispensing of benzodiazepines and opioids. And we cut it down in, I think, 40 or 50% in 7 or 8 months. And that was talking directly with surgeons who were writing it as benzodiazepines as a muscle relaxant, or talking with patients who had maybe they or their prescriber had gone straight to benzodiazepines for anxiety before trying SSRIs or even Buspar, and kind of having these individual conversations. We all got together We sent one message, just like you do with early fills of own controls. We sent one message to patients, one set of policies, and started getting these patients off and then measuring that. And so that's an example. So I kind of always had these going on the side outside of the dispensing stuff in the pharmacy.
Were those self-directed? Did you start those when you had a regular job, you know, like a, in quotes, like a regular job? You were thinking of these, and so you sort of created that position.
Yeah, I essentially created the position that I'm in now. And it wasn't my intent necessarily when I started it. I've always been just internally driven to make the place better. I think I kind of have that quality improvement mindset. You know, I'll walk around looking at stuff that could be done better. So I guess I have that going for me and being able to visualize it. And, you know, have worked with a lot of great folks inside the health system that have put their talents to use in making those improvements a reality.
I think that is a huge skill in today's market that a lot of people are never going to be cut out for the founding CEO of a huge company. A lot of times just the chips don't fall in that direction. And there's so much that individuals can do. Anybody can do that in their career by being that problem solver, having that skill of wanting to improve stuff, because everybody says, well, I'm not this person or I'm not that person, but you can do that wherever you are and become that cog that is needed, that people can do that when they wake up today, driving into work. You think, oh, I'm only this position. There's really no such thing to make yourself indispensable like that, right?
There's not. It's really completely independent of job title. And you know, like the position that I'm in now, I say project manager because it kind of approximates it the best, but I'm basically getting paid to unleash my own fury, I guess.
Does anybody give you that title, or is that just a title that you self-profess then on your own stuff?
I kind of self-profess it, but I think a lot of people in the company struggle to say what my job title is to other people.
I love that.
Sometimes we've been talking before and we've struggled to know who my boss is. And I've had this before with directors, and it's like, why do your time card? And I've told them, well, heck, it really doesn't matter who my boss is.
Yes.
I said, my goal is for you to never have to deal with who my boss is. That's the kind of employee every company wants. They don't, the boss never has to know who the boss is. If you need to know who your boss is, you're doing something
wrong.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, focused on just fixing things around, whether it was, most of it was within pharmacy, most of it was within outpatient pharmacy, but not 100% of the time, just kind of doing it one after the other. So when I went part-time, I asked to go part-time in 2019 because the medical writing business had kind of taken off. I landed a gig with Walters Kluwer being a part of a team to write a NAPLEX review course. And so that was giving a lot of steady work. I rented a co-working space. I still remember that feeling of like spending a work day in the co-working space and how good it felt, you know, to have a day there.
The co-working space, that's like the Uber-ish of, that's like a shared office kind of thing, or what is that?
It is, yeah. Yeah, and you can rent individual private offices, or you can just subscribe. Most co-working spaces, you can kind of pay them a monthly subscription to have access to their common areas, which is just like couches, tables, like wherever you want to sit, Wi-Fi, there's plenty of plugs, you know, electric plugs and stuff. So you just like get set up over there and get to work.
But I mean, you could do that anywhere, but that's like a huge thing to say that you were able to fund it / be serious enough to get your own space to do this. And I bet when you walked in there, I bet creativity went off the charts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I just like those co-working spaces, because especially they're typically competing with other spaces. That, I mean, they just make it so beautiful inside. Like, yeah, just when you walk in the morning, it just lifts your mood, basically. So
how far was that from home?
It was about 20, 25 minutes. So I did it for the co-working space. I did for quite a while. And then I stopped going to it maybe I don't remember, 4 or 5 months before COVID hit, primarily because of the commute and that time you lose. Because you think about that as a freelancer, like you're spending 45, 50 minutes commuting total in a day. You could kind of like, do you do that every day? You could write extra pieces. So for me, that ultimately ended up being the reason why I left that particular co-working space. But it doesn't change the fact that I loved going to the co-working space. I loved working in that space.
Arguably, I bet you could almost make a case for saying that 45 minutes was well spent, because you got on fire when you were there, you know, writing and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you definitely can.
How do you compare writing there versus, you know, at home?
It kind of depends on the day, but I love the atmosphere of the co-working space. Yeah, I mean, it's only natural you're going to feel that way. And the high ceilings, like I enjoy going to Starbucks too, but like the high ceilings of the co-working space, I think they just designed the acoustics to be a little less noisy on average than compared to your Starbucks or whatever other coffee shop you might go to. But the beautiful thing is you really can work anywhere. Like I've set up, And even at Ascension now, like a lot of what I do is work from home. So whether I'm writing or for Ascension, a lot of times I've set up my computer at the picnic table in my backyard. So you're just working in the backyard for a while. And
okay, we got to cover a few things before we get deeper into the writing. First of all, you're in Florida now.
Yes.
One of my sons, when he was about 4 or 5, he said, "Dad, when you die, can you go anywhere you want?" I'm like, "Anywhere, Lance, that's the freedom of death. You know, you're not in your body anymore and you go anywhere you want to and this and that." And he says, "Anywhere?" I said, "Yeah." And I thought he was going to get into, like, you know, he wanted to go through the rings of Saturn and this and that, you know. And he thinks and he says, "I'm going to go to Florida." So, all right. So, here's my point. You've already conquered that dream of my son. So then you've also spent time in Hawaii. And other people would say that's the pinnacle. But here's my pinnacle of what I want to talk to you about. My listeners may know that one of my dreams through my life was learning to sight read very well at the piano. And I've worked on that for 30 some years. But along with that dream, and I've kind of had the direction to go, I could either sight read very well or really get into jazz, all the scales and all that stuff. And so my son wants to go to Florida when he dies. When I die, I hope that I open my eyes up and I'm sitting at a piano and I'm fluently playing all the jazz scales, not reading, because I took that path of sight reading versus jazz. And you've done that, right? You're a pianist?
I do play piano, yeah.
In a jazz band you played in college.
I did, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. And pharmacy school, got into Cuban dance music, so talk about it.
What, your pharmacy school? You mean you had a Cuban dance day or something?
UNC Chapel Hill's a big university. They got a huge music program, too. I would say an outstanding music program for any listeners who are maybe going there, considering going there and like music. I had a great experience there. And one of the school ensembles was a Cuban dance band. The professor, David Garcia, spent his time in his doctoral studies kind of looking into the origins of Cuban music and what eventually became New York style salsa. And started an ensemble there. So we played everything from, like, it's called danzón, the early, like, Cuban music. It's from the early 1900s all the way up to, yeah, big band salsa. So
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's kind of a big passion. Now I do play jazz too, and it's of course easier to play jazz in small groups and get to play out and stuff. So I play it a lot and really enjoy it too.
Now, when you play jazz, one of the key components of jazz is improvisation. So you're fluent at the scales?
I think like any musician would say, I don't know what point you would call it fluent, you know, certainly.
Yeah, right.
You've got New York City jazz musicians that can, you know, look at something in C and play it in F sharp while they're reading it in C.
Yeah.
And yeah, I can't do that at all. But yeah, I'd say I can play well enough to fit in a jam session. And
personally, because I can't really do it, but you got to be really, really smart to do that.
I think just a lot of work. It was really hard. Yeah, it was really hard.
Yeah, I guess so. Because when some people think that you're improvising, but you're also doing licks that you have some favorite licks that you do during your improvisation, right?
Oh, yeah. And that's a big component of the musician's individual style. You can hear that in any instrument. Yeah, from jazz musicians.
Yeah, that's part of the reason why I like to sight read, because I used to play blues in just kind of the key of C. That's the only scale I knew it in. But I would start to do some things too repetitively, and I thought, I want to break out from this a little bit. But I envy the jazz players. But okay, so speaking of smart, all right, so I'm going to go through your whole
life.
This is your life, Alex. All right, so you first go to college and you end up the top of your class basically in biology.
Although I did start the first semester as a piano performance major, and I switched. Yeah,
wow,
I did.
So that was serious. We got down to the guts of this now. I nailed it. So you started as piano performance.
I did, yeah. And I was getting to the point where I was doing it to the point where I didn't really enjoy the piano anymore. And that was after one semester.
Happens,
for a
right?
variety of reasons, as I'm sure there are listeners here who are pharmacists who are music majors. Because I had even one or two in my class that probably understand the realities of ear training and juries and music theory and everything else that comes along with music majors, sitting in the music practice closets for hours a day. But
took the love out of it, right?
For me it did, yeah. Which let me know it wasn't right for me.
Yeah.
You know, some people would drive their passion even more to practice like that, but in my case it just didn't.
Did you know right away, or did that take a lot of soul searching to switch? Or did you, like, the first days you were in there, you felt like you were in a prison?
I think it took a little time for me.
Yeah.
But I knew over time, but I knew I especially knew I'd made the right decision at juries. And juries, for those of you who are not music majors, that's where you walk in, you've been working on, let's say, four pieces the entire semester. You've been working your tail off on them. And they typically assign a Baroque piece. So I had a Bach invention. They assign, for example, a Romantic era piece. So I had Mozart. And then they might assign one or two other little pieces. I think I had a Chopin piece. So at the end of the semester at juries, they have all the piano professors there, all six or seven of them. You walk in. They've got a clipboard there. They're sitting back so they can grade you. And you're like, okay, let's go in chronological order. We'll start with the Bach. Go ahead. And you've been working and you play it until they're tired of hearing you, until they know what grade you get. So you might have practiced the entire thing, but you play like a third of it. Okay, you can stop there. All right, moving on to the Mozart. And you start that.
And I'm sure they're not clapping afterwards.
Oh, not at all. No, not at all. No, they're writing the notes, critiquing everything you did. Mozart, okay, now the Chopin. So
do you have the music in front of you, or do you have to memorize it?
No, you do have to memorize it. That's part of the music major.
That's part of the major thing.
Yeah, you develop to the point of even in undergrad, the Bachelor of Music is giving a recital of, you know, an hour of music or something. And
oh my gosh.
You know, yeah.
If you were in charge of that curriculum with that same degree name, would you do it any different for the students? Like, if you were in charge, would you change any? I mean, I know you didn't like it, but do you think it's still a good setup?
My biggest criticism of the majority of music schools in the country is that it doesn't provide musicians who can meet the market demand for music. So what I mean by that is, you know, the sole focus is on what we typically call classical music, you know, basically starting from the Baroque era all the way up to maybe, you know, the Debussy and the more modern still would be considered classical music. And they drill that and drill that and drill that. This phrasing could be better, your pedaling or the staccato and whatnot. But they graduate and they don't. That's all the many of those musicians know how to play. So you either go into music education and you teach music in the K through 12 schools, or you go to get a master's and then a doctoral degree in music, and then you might teach at a university. Now, that is to say, of course, there are numerous jazz programs out there, and those musicians, I feel like, are going to have a lot more jobs. Cruise ships, for example, are a big employer, and hotels and just gigging on their own. But that classical path, I just don't see where they're going to make a living. And one of my first jazz piano instructors in high school graduated with a classical piano degree and basically taught himself to play jazz later. And of course, he had the fundamentals down already, but taught himself to play jazz later because I think he enjoyed it, but basically because he had to. So I kind of subscribe more to the Berklee College of Music model, which is we're going to teach you to play everything. Like, they have reggae bands and gospel, Cuban dance bands. Of course, you play some classical, blues. And so they graduate really well-rounded, and they can fit in with any job. So they could walk in already well-versed. They walk into a reggae band. You got a reggae gig. Whether or not you like reggae, and most people who are musicians are open to a wide variety of music. I rarely hear musicians say, what kind of music do you listen to? Because it just comes across as a narrow focus to anybody who is a musician. But whether or not you like reggae, for example, they're paying $300 for a night, you're going to play reggae. You know, and that's just, it's like what we do as a pharmacist. Maybe some things we do we don't like doing, but we do them because it's part of our job. And it should be the same in music, that, you know, you play anything whether you like it or not, because it puts food on the table.
Yeah. And I've tried to do it with my reading too, is I'll go through and I'll pick pretty much any style. The easiest stuff for me to play is, like, you know, old Frank Sinatra stuff, you know, like the 40s music. It's just got a nice beat. I love the chord progression. It's not too fast for me and so on. But the last couple nights I've been playing from, I pulled up a book. I subscribed to this program called Scribd, and it's audio books and real books. But one of the things in there is piano music. So I just pull up these books I haven't seen before and I play. So I've been playing 80s music. And so those are hard to play, you know, to be playing the beats of some things. It just never sounds like it really flows together too well. But my wife listens, and after about 3 minutes, she says, "Oh, I recognize it." It's like, I'm trying to get that down to about 10 seconds for her to recognize it.
Yeah.
All right, Alex. These conversations are always what I would truly ask somebody if we were, you know, hanging out for a drive or sitting in a coffee shop or something. And so I want to skip over pharmacy school, but I want to skip to 4 years later of you getting your MBA. So what was the decision of that after 4 or 5 years to say, I'm going to get my MBA now?
You know, I think it was a few reasons. At the time I'd come on as pharmacy manager and really thought I wanted to basically get an MBA to be able to go after other opportunities higher in management and leadership within Ascension, owning so many hospitals and inpatient and outpatient pharmacies. There are tons of niche jobs within that health system, and there are with many companies, including the big chains. And so getting and often even with big chains, you know, they want an MBA in order to consider you for those types of jobs. So I thought I wanted to get higher into people management was probably one big reason. And then the second big reason, unfortunately, is the job market. You know, it's like I figured with a PharmD and an MBA, it's a diverse enough skill set that I could switch over to insurance, healthcare consulting, I don't know, a wide variety of jobs. Or I could, if I had to, I could get out of healthcare for a while and, you know, do something strictly business if I needed to. So unfortunately, yeah, it was partially the job market. I still don't have any regrets. I learned a lot in business school. Yeah, it was a great experience. I highly recommend the program I went to, I highly recommend, is West Texas A&M University. They were really affordable.
So you'd recommend that?
I would. Yeah, I learned a ton. West Texas A&M is where I personally went to school, but it's has the AACSB accreditation, which is a kind of a gold standard for business schools. Extremely affordable, fully online format. And especially, I thought, the accounting and finance core. I took a class called Quantitative Analysis in Business, which was really, really helpful, and I thought, in approaching business problems and understanding how business decisions are made using the data that's presented. And actually, shortly after even taking the first semester of accounting, when we were really digging into our income statements at the hospital, yeah, I realized the revenue was just, despite prescription growth, the revenue was stagnant, and just kept digging and digging, because I kind of had more of an understanding of how to read an income statement. Eventually discovered a billing error.
Really?
With our insulin pens, and backbilled the claims. Actually, I worked with our national rep for our insurance, you know, our insurer,
yeah,
to be able to go back 12 months and backbilled,
wow,
every single one of those claims. It's like, told the other manager at our other location, come on over for the day, bring some coffee, put in a float pharmacist for your location for the day, and we're just going to knock these claims out. And we knocked out, you know, all of them over the course of that day, plus I did a few others over the course of the next few days. A ton of work, but we actually recovered $250,000 in revenue and it was really like, it was more of a software quirk, I would say, as much as anything else. It's the kind of mistake any pharmacy could make, assuming the software allowed that type of error to be made. So it's not like it was, you know, it was an irresponsible thing or anything like that. It was an oversight, but the end result was that over the course of a year, it could have cost us $250,000 if it wasn't discovered. So I think that was one of the first points when I realized just how valuable my education, my business education was.
It's kind of like somebody who says, oh, I don't listen to rap, it's all the same, or I don't listen to symphonies, they're all the same. It's like, no, if you look at them enough times, you start to see some differences. And I'm sure that before the business, you know, that business even just allowed you to see that and not have your eyes gloss over right then to look into those things even.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I agree completely. And just being able to speak the vocabulary, you know, like I ultimately decided at this time I don't want to continue in people management, but just taking responsibility as a business owner and thinking as a business owner and digging and digging until you find what's the best thing for the organization, I think that's going to get you noticed anywhere you go. And I felt like the MBA gave me a lot of the tools to do that. So a good example of that is when we were looking at starting a new initiative and kind of figuring out where to put this particular service line that we were going to add, and getting the raw data on prescription volumes from all the various clinics. The business education gave me the ability, I was actually taking finance at the time, to calculate what's called the net present value, which is essentially how you can measure up which location or which business decision will produce the most income in today's dollars for the business. And that's something you learn in MBA school, is here's how you calculate a net present value, here's what it means. That kind of vocabulary, if you want to be taken seriously by anybody in upper leadership of any company, you have to speak that vocabulary.
Yeah, because a lot of times, I was just listening to Freakonomics this morning, their podcast, and they were talking to these guys about advertising, and this guy pulled out an advertising term. Basically, he was trying to pull one over on him because he didn't think the other guy knew the lingo, and he did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
My history with the MBA is I had worked at my family's pharmacy for a year or two, and I said, I'm going to get my MBA because same reasons that you were talking. And so one class I needed before MBA school was accounting. And so I took a 3-week accounting class, and the Monday night was 4 hours. So that's a whole week of accounting. And then Tuesday I had to do homework for the whole week because Wednesday had a 4-hour class too. So we had basically 2 weeks within 3 days. So I hated the class and I thought, well, I made it through. And then there was a 4th of July happened to fall on a Monday. And then the second semester of accounting was going to start up the next week. And so I get there on that Monday for the next 3-week class and I'm sitting there and I find out that the class had started the Wednesday before. There was a 4th of July on the Monday and then they started a 3-week class on Wednesday night. And I'm thinking, who the hell starts a class on a Wednesday night? You know? I go in there on Monday and I'm still hoping for, you know, hi everybody, I'm Mike. I'm looking for the introduction.
For the sticker on the shirt.
Shirt and play some name game or something. And this guy's already into a second week writing on the board at about 1 minute after 6 o'clock. And so.
Oh, wow.
I packed That's it in tough. And that was my decision to not get my MBA. The average naysayer of the MBA will say, oh, it's too much numbers and too much this and that, but it sounds to me like it was a really good mix for you.
Well, yeah, I guess the one rebuttal I would have to that is, you know, I hate to break it to everybody here, but when you work for a business, your job is a number. And that's not to be impersonal. They can manage in a personal way, but at the end of the day, businesses have to stay afloat and you have to bring more to the business than you take in salary and benefits. And anybody who's had conversations with upper leadership knows those calculations because they're responsible for them. Does it make sense? How much revenue are we going to bring in? Let's look at the FTEs, multiply, add 25% for benefits. You know, they put it on, it's called a pro forma, for example. It's basically a proposed income statement of what your salary is going to cost and whether or not it will bring in money. So it's better if you understand that and understand those numbers. And I wouldn't say that the MBA is the only way to attain that knowledge. Of course, there are plenty of people that maybe don't have any formal degrees in business who have attained much more knowledge than I'll ever have. But for me, it was a great path because I'd never had any business education, hadn't taken one business class, wouldn't have even known where to start looking to learn about business. So I felt like I needed that structure and, you know, that formal program to really learn what experienced business educators felt like were important aspects to learn, and that's the MBA.
You're saying that, I know it's a lot of numbers, but here's two things to learn from it. One thing is realize that you're just a number, and so if you think business is a number, and your number might be up if, second lesson, you don't bring extra value to your job and up your game competitively, maybe against your team members. Did I capture that right?
I wouldn't even have to say it needs to be competitively. If you bring a lot of extra value to the business, you know, what your coworkers do is kind of just understand that it's a business decision. And that goes for nonprofits too. And one of my former bosses said about the nonprofit, she says, if you don't have any money, you can't help anybody. And that has always stuck with me because it's so true. So nonprofits, it doesn't eliminate the money factor with nonprofits. And it's not because nonprofits are bad. They do a lot of amazing work. But money is what allows them to do it. Otherwise, they wouldn't need fundraising. They wouldn't need donations. And they wouldn't need revenue streams. I would be shocked if you could find a nonprofit with zero revenue that's making any kind of an impact on anybody.
Someone in your same position may have hated numbers, but they might have been real good at, geez, it might have even been like hospitality. Maybe they've got a real good thought process on that, and they're going to bring ideas to the company of how to make customers feel more
absolutely
welcome. And someone else might have a real good grab on speaking or marketing, and they might not get into the numbers, but they're going to be able to put input in of some kind of a conference or something like that. So in this day and age, you've really got to bring more to your job.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And companies are looking for that diversity in their hiring, or they should be. And one thing I do remember from business school is there actually have been studies demonstrating that diversity on the board, diversity in leadership within companies leads to higher performance than homogenous companies. So that the same would go with frontline employees. You definitely need that different thought process, but everybody needs to be thinking about more beyond I clock in and I get paid and it's my job. Because at some point that's just much more easily replaceable, and that's the thing, is you kind of want to make yourself difficult. Everybody should have a succession plan too, so that, you know, if it does come your time, you don't want all your work to collapse and this company that's been feeding you and your family for years to collapse. But at the same time, you do want to bring so much value that they think, well, I don't know what I'd do without this person. Who wouldn't want to be in that position?
Sometimes that's going to be without competition. A company might truly look and say what they need. In other cases, they might have, you know, 100 employees and they got to get rid of 20 of them. And that's where you'd rather be bringing something extra than not, probably.
Yeah, absolutely.
One thing I love about, speaking of bringing things to the company, do you speak Japanese?
To some extent, yeah. That's another thing.
Did you learn that in school?
I did not. Mostly self-taught. My wife is from Japan. I actually met her in Hawaii. And when we first started dating, kind of asked her, like, do your parents speak English at all? Does your family speak English at all? And of course, now I know the answer is obviously no. The majority of people in Japan speak one language, which is Japanese. Yeah. It's not like a Nordic country where, oh, I speak Swedish, but everybody in the country speaks English too, you know, fluently, like they're a native speaker. Japan is very different.
It's a big enough economy, right? And a big enough country where they don't feel like they have to speak English to make it in the world, sort of thing. Would that be fair or not?
And I think, too, the education system, just like our education system in the U.S., is not very conducive to actually learning languages. And so in Japan, there's a big emphasis on writing and grammar and things where it's, like testing, for example. We take multiple choice tests. I remember I took German in college. I don't speak German, but I took German in college. And I remember getting tested on, like, which one of these is the dative form, I think, of this verb. And it's like, yeah, if you learn German like that, you're not going to learn German or any other language. So it's the same in Japan, I think, the education system. But bottom line, you just got to screw up and screw up and screw up. You just got to keep talking and you got to get laughed at and, you know, and it's hard. And
those Germans, they've got some cool long words, don't they?
Oh, yeah, yes,
you know,
they
they've
do.
Got like, you know, like in the U.S., I wish I had a good example for the listeners, but
the only thing that comes to mind for me is what did they have, some far from puking shirts or something for a while?
yeah.
Sorry, that's not German, but
no,
but yeah.
And they got a lot of words for things like where we might say, I'm just going to throw this out. You know, we might say somebody is grumpy, you know, their word might be something like in German, like old man with a scowl on his face, you know, something like that. They just have these long words. They put them all together.
And there's no space.
I think anybody can just make up a word. You just chain together a sentence and take up the spaces. And you're like, that's a new German word.
Throw a couple of those umlauts in there. Ooh.
My last name's Kelzer. So in English, it's K-O-E, but it's really a O umlaut instead of that.
Oh,
you know?
Is it? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Do you think people from China are more focused on English than people from Japan?
In Japan, there's certainly a big focus on English. It's just not really working very well to teach English. It doesn't seem like. There are tons of jobs, even for native speakers, teaching English. That's one of the most common ways Americans live in Japan, is going to teach English.
Oh, is that right?
At a high school or middle school or, heck, even kindergarten. So they have those resources there, but it's just, yeah, I think the instruction, the way they're teaching it and all, and I guess I'm not sure with China, it seems like that, you know, that might be a struggle in China too. I have actually one client I just signed on with. It's a Chinese company that I know that I don't speak Chinese, but they put in their ad they would prefer if the writer also spoke some Chinese, so I think they're, you know, they were looking for that to some extent.
If you want to pick a fight with them, you can tell them that all the instructions that come from the Chinese products don't always nail down the English exactly, you know. I'm always thinking with these Chinese products that come over and, you know, the instructions are like, could you have had at least one person with native English read through this? You know, you would have known this wasn't the right verb there or something, you know, or, and it doesn't take much to throw it off. It's just like one word out of hundreds, and you can tell it's like, they should have had someone look at this. But what do I know? I don't know the languages. I just know an English looks funny, you know?
Yeah. Well, the little bit I've heard of from translation, I did work editing English translation, so basically doing that, but to go in a peer-reviewed journal. And the one thing I have learned from it is there's like different levels of translation. So there's people with lower proficiency that would be like me that might get paid the bottom of the rung at best. And they might be responsible for like, you know, translating a Twitter post or something like that. And then there's people like, and you only translate into your own native language, but then there are other people, maybe they've lived in Japan 20 years and they, you know, very comfortable, and they focus on like medical translation, and they might translate packages, whatever. Sure. I don't know, presentations.
Yeah, something
or
a little
something
more detailed.
Like that. Yeah. So I bet those instructions, they probably come from the lower rung. It's like, and it sounds like from native Chinese speakers rather than from native English speakers who speak some Chinese.
I think so. I think so. Even if writing never made it to the light of day, you know, even if you wrote, but you had to throw all your writing away, I think it's so valuable to capture your thoughts and put them in order. There's just something really, really strong there, you know, about writing something out. Where did your writing start from? Was your writing the chicken or the egg? I mean, have you always felt like you had the thoughts coming out and you finally put them down? Or did you write in order to order your thoughts and so on? Where is your organization thoughts and writing? Are you writing to organize, or have you organized and writing just puts it into thoughts?
I've always enjoyed kind of writing to at least organize goals. What would I want to accomplish this year, for example? And I like to put those down in writing. I feel like there really is a lot of value in doing that. Like, I want to do, you know, X, X, and X over the course of this year, these three items. And I write that down maybe at the beginning of the year, for example, or just even like collecting thoughts around a business or collecting thoughts about it. Yeah, I do it at work too with Ascension, like having lists and kind of writing down like this is where we really need to go. And
it's almost like you could throw that stuff away, you know, the fact of writing it and having to say, I put this in 3 points. Some people are like, well, they like the feeling of the paper and the pencil in their hand. I know all that stuff, but I mean just being able to. Here's an example. Sometimes when I have something on my mind, you know, a project on my mind or a story in my head or something that happened, I can think about it over, and I'm not talking a list, like keeping track of a list in my head. I'm talking like, what just happened with that? You can think about it over and over in your head, and then you can write it down. And I don't mean write it down like now you have your do list. I mean, just to write it down, there's a huge divide and a huge power there of going from your head into your hand onto paper or onto a computer of organization. I think it's underrated.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's been a great way for me to collect my thoughts. And with medical writing, of course, it's different, but with my own kind of goals and thoughts and directions about things, yeah, I found it to be very valuable to really just be able to put it down. And this is what I focus on. You know, these are the, what we call maybe the valuable few, for those that are familiar with, for example, a Pareto analysis, which is that there's like 20% of the problems cause 80% of the issues. Like there's a few things that lead to a large impact, and it not just with problems, but there might be a lot of demands on your time, on all, you know, all sorts of people are going to want your time. So where are the, where, what is your 20, what is your 20%? Like, what is, what are your 20% of items that should be taking 80% of your time? And where are those priorities?
But you walk into a bookstore, you know, and there's just thousands of books, you know, there's hundreds of different categories. And then you go to your category and there's 10 shelves. And finally you're down to, you know, one book and then one chapter and one page, you know, and it's like the whole bookstore could have been in that book, but someone had thought enough to get it that narrowed down. And so it's maybe not so much the stuff that's on your paper, as you just said, maybe it's the stuff that's not on your paper that everybody's brain wants to still bring into it. The billions of points that are not on your paper is maybe the important part to say, no, this is not what we're focusing on.
Yeah. And I've struggled with that in the past. And, you know, last year I purposely did it and said, I'm going to try for 1 year really, really hard to make several businesses work. And I probably took on too much, and there was a lot of demand on my time and, you know, all these different ideas kind of pulling in different directions. And that was kind of the point, probably the highest point I've had with just multiple demands on my time. And like I said, I given at the beginning of that year that I'm going to cut it off at the end of this year if it does, you know, if it's not working out. And that's what I ultimately did. But I know during that time I had a whole lot of too many things going on at once. And yeah, something I certainly have struggled with in the past too, is what are your two things or three things? What is it that you can really focus on that, you know, where you can accomplish those things and still keep your sanity in the process?
Alex, how do you define medical writing? Is that subjective?
To me, it's subjective. I know the American Medical Writers Association probably has a different definition of it, and they probably define it narrowly. But this is something I put in my medical writing course and in articles too that I've written about the topic, is that I think one thing that will hold you back with medical writing is worrying too much about what medical writing is. So like the way I see it is, if I'm getting paid a salary that I am happy with to write, life is good. Who cares if you call it medical writing if you want, call it general writing. It makes no difference to me what you want to call it. So a good example, I wrote for a while for this company called Barton Staffing. They do healthcare staffing for like locum tenens, usually I think focus on nursing and physicians, but some pharmacist kind of temp jobs. So as a locum tenum company, of course they were open to pitching some articles on travel and look, this is what you can do in this state or that state. So I got paid to write a few articles on Hawaii. So I wrote an article like top 5 dive sites on Maui. I sent them a link to my YouTube video. They put their logo on it and they put it on their site. And I made a list of, you know, these are my favorite places that I dove on Maui when I was there. And they paid me for it. So they're a healthcare staffing firm, but it's about dive sites. Is it medical writing? I guess I don't know, but I was happy to write it.
Part of that was like with the show, like my only rule on this show is that we don't get to talk about any medicine. I don't enjoy it. I mean, I can find that somewhere. I enjoy the business side of more things. So that's really, is like, what do you talk about on your show? It's like, yeah, anything except medicine.
I might have violated that rule earlier with the benzo opioid stuff, but I just meant it as an example.
If it's got a Latin name to it, one show I actually got into a little bit, you know, I got into a little bit more medical stuff. Yeah, if it's got a Latin name, it's not for this show. It's everything kind of around that. So the medical writing in your mind is just, you know, probably your audience is maybe that profession. And it's not so much maybe what's actually in the article. It's not like it has to have drug names in it or something like that. It's really the audience that you're after, it seems.
That's the way it is in my mind. Yeah. And I wouldn't be against travel writing. You know, if one of those travel magazines had an opening or contacted me and the pay was good enough, I wouldn't expect it to be as high as, you know, writing, editing peer-reviewed journals or something. But if I get to talk about Hawaii and put it in a travel magazine, I'd be open to that too. I say medical writer, but I'm open to other other types of writing too. Yeah. So yeah, most of the stuff I've done has been like consumer health. I write for GoodRx's blog and they do some consumer health stuff and some pharmacy operations stuff. And I've written continuing education and some trade journals. And I mentioned the NAPLEX review course. So I guess really just whatever comes up that I feel like I'm capable of taking on. You know, I haven't done, for example, regulatory writing. I wouldn't be comfortable doing it without being supervised by a regulatory writer. But if I feel like I'm capable of doing it and they're going to pay me and I'm happy to do it, then who cares what you call it?
All right, Alex, correct me if I'm wrong then. So at times, if you need more business for your writing, you look up the person to contact at these companies, you send them a little example of this and you say, can I write for you and will you pay me? Where am I wrong on that?
I have done that, yeah. And especially when I first got started writing. And that's another thing I go over in the course is I talk about where to find these companies, how to search for jobs on, you know, your Indeeds and Glassdoors of the world, how to search the company's pages, and how to pitch to the editor of those places.
What's the contact for the course?
It's on Udemy.
Udemy.com.
Yeah, medical writing for healthcare professionals. And yeah, I'll send a link to add to the notes.
Is it video? People watch you or they read it or what do they do?
Actually, a little bit of both. So I do some video of myself, do some video with PowerPoints, do a lot of screenshots. And the focus of my course is not necessarily how to write. This is assuming that you are a healthcare professional, that you're comfortable with writing, but you don't know how to get started getting paid to write. So taking you from zero, where you are now, for example, you work at a pharmacy and you want to even start writing on the side, even if you don't want to leave your pharmacy career, you just want to get paid a little extra to write on the side and have a good time. I feel like the course is still for you. So it's kind of broken down into finding the jobs, pitching to the clients, building your portfolio up, efficiently writing the work. And the focus isn't really on how to, you know, sentence structure and things of that nature, but how to quickly lay everything out so that you get the work done in the most efficient way possible, because you typically get paid per project, that kind of thing. It's not per hour is not as common, I would say, as per project or per word.
And you said you're not talking about how to lay out the article like in the reverse pyramid and stuff they teach. We're talking really nothing about the article itself, more about getting the article done and so on.
Yeah, exactly. So laying out an outline, for example, what types of styles work best for the web. So that's one of my preview videos on the course. But for example, the web loves lists, top five places on Maui, top four, I did one for Pharmacy Times, top, I think, four or five confusing drug formulations. So actually in that video, and this is what I do in the course with this section on writing the work, I actually have a screenshot video of my own computer and I'm writing out outlines from scratch. So I did, I think for the writing for the web, I think I did a sample called Top Five Places in Hawaii. And we don't finish the piece because that's not the point, is to finish the piece, but get it in 10 to 15 minutes laid out with your main points and an intro and how to go back and then plug in those references. You know, when is it the most efficient to look up those types of facts? So if you're writing a piece on blood pressure and you need to look up how many people are affected by blood pressure, by high blood pressure and complications and those kind of things, you have to look those things up. When is it the most efficient to look that up? When is it the most efficient to put the reference in there? How to most efficiently create the references? Essentially get it done as quickly as you can, and also get a piece that's well formed so that you can submit high quality work.
Right now, I say to you, Alex, go get something that's going to be magazine or, you know, website ready. You don't have an idea yet. You've got to come up with a five list article on something. How many hours are you putting into that?
Well, I would say with the amount of practice I've gotten, it's gotten better than when I first started because I've done so many of them. But the standard length for the web is kind of 600 to 800 words is what a lot of people talk about. An article with a list, I would say, you know, anywhere from 200 to 300, 350 is kind of the going rate for that. And I could probably do it in as little as, I've knocked one of those out in 45 minutes to an hour on the very low end, and I've gone 4 to 5 hours on the high end, depending on how much research and the editor. For example, if you need primary sources for everything and it's a real in-depth kind of article. So an example of one that's on the high end in terms of time is GoodRx. It's consumer health, and they, you know, it's like, I think I did one, atorvastatin versus simvastatin, which one is better, and kind of digging into side effects and things that, that of course you're going to have to look more things up. You have to make sure it's referenced well, and it takes more time than top five dives.
Primary being, well, the simple example would be, you don't want to say, I saw this on this article that referenced that article. You have to go to that original article, basically.
Yeah, pull in the original trial data or guidelines, something that's really reliable in the end. Even if you know it off the top of your head, you still have to reference it, because they need to maintain their reputation as well. And, you know, that, that everything they put on their website is referenced from reliable sources.
It seems to me that a lot of times in an article, especially with the list articles, that you're not reinventing the wheel. You're not saying, here's how to build the next levitating car or something. You're really conglomerating things that are out there. It seems to me that the whole key to an article is thinking of the topic and then actually finding items for the list. That's more like, all right, now it's coming together. Is that right? Is the topic the most difficult thing to come up with?
And communicating the material effectively. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I don't think anything I've written, well, I know nothing I've written has been groundbreaking stuff. I haven't conducted trials myself. Everything that I've looked up is already is already out there, you know.
Right.
So it's, but there's a reason that they call it, that the places where medical writers work are called medical communications agencies. And the reason they're called medical communicators too is laying that out and communicating that information in an effective way, to increase retention, to increase the time that the person spends on that website. So that's another thing, because anybody who's into websites knows that time, like page views and the amount of time on each page, that all affects how much a website is going to get paid in ad revenue, which is where your salary comes from. So this is where I'm going back to, you need to bring more to the company than you're taking. So you get paid $200 for an article or $300 or something. But, you know, I had one editor, occasionally we hit a home run, and it's hard to tell what's going to be a home run, but we hit one time and they got 16,000 page views in like 3 or 4 days. And, you know, she was ecstatic about it. And of course, that's because her boss was happy, and her boss was happy because there are more page views equals more ad revenue, which is where my money comes from.
That's interesting about the length, because some people will go on and see something's too long and not even start in it. But if it's too short, they're going to read it and get off of it. So there must be a sweet spot in there.
There is. Most people say around 600 to 800 words. And sometimes you'll see like authority websites will do much longer ones. But another thing they'll do is kind of a bottom line or summary, either at the top or the bottom of the page. And you see that GoodRx, the typical one with GoodRx is the bottom line. And you'll see that if you go to their blog, most of the articles would have a bottom line. I think Healthline does a similar thing. They highlight it in a box with bullet points at the top or something, but that's a very common thing, not just in healthcare, but other sites.
That's the little trailer sort of, right? That's to catch attention, and then they hope they read more?
Yeah, exactly. Do I want to read this article or not? And you see the few bullet points and you scroll more. I think I've even seen news websites doing it about, you know, the recent happenings of whatever they're reporting on.
They say the first thing that people read in a letter is the PS.
Oh yeah, I've never heard that. That's a good point though. Yeah, it's kind of like the PS.
Do they put the bottom line at the bottom line, or do they put it up on top?
GoodRx does actually put it at the bottom.
It doesn't use much finger energy. I think a lot of people do scroll down. They look at the bottom line, actually, because wisdom would say, no, don't put it down there, because then they got to scroll down and up again and that. But, you know, probably at the bottom is okay, because then people will go back up. I always read articles from bottom to top. You know, you go in, you say, oh, that's an interesting conclusion. You start reading, and finally I get to the top paragraph.
It must be working, because GoodRx, I can't remember, 20 million users a month or something. It's a lot. They have an enormous audience. So whatever their formula is, definitely working.
You don't mean just users of the discount. You mean reading the articles. There's a lot of people.
No, that is the site. So I don't know how much is like searching the drugs versus reading the articles. But I imagine with that many people visiting the site, there's a lot of people reading, and that of course means for anybody in that internet kind of world that they're gonna be at the top of the Google pecking order. You know, when somebody searches, what's this rash under my armpit? Probably GoodRx is gonna come to the top of the page if they have a blog article about it because of traffic and things like that.
How long does your course take to get through?
I think it's a little under 3 hours, but Udemy does give you lifetime access. And my intent was for it to be a place you go back and forth almost as much as like you go through it all at once and then you don't ever touch it again. My course is not designed for that.
Because it is a stepwise process on this stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Back on your MBA, would you still get your MBA if you couldn't put MBA on your name?
I still think it was a really, really valuable educational process. That would be hard for me to answer because I gained so much from the MBA, but also it just seems to be like a checklist item for so many jobs that if you can't walk away at least saying you have that body of knowledge and prove it to your employers, it was a big commitment to not be able to demonstrate to employers that you have that.
If someone said, you can't use the MBA on the end of your name, you might say, I still want to learn this stuff, but maybe I'll learn it in half the time or not get as deep or something like that. It's a value of both, right?
Yeah, it is. And at least if I could put it on my resume, I don't care what they put on the end of my name.
Yeah.
But if I couldn't at least put it on my resume to demonstrate to employers, yeah, whether or not I'm introduced as, you know, PharmD MBA is kind of irrelevant to me. But I do want to be able to show employers that I can talk that talk.
But it's good on your little bio on your writings, though, wouldn't you think? That's probably good.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And actually, within writing, often the medical communications agencies, you start out as a writer. The next natural step is a publications manager.
Gotcha.
So you're managing multiple writers and stuff. And so I imagine they probably value an MBA too, just like any other company.
Would you do that?
Possibly. Yeah. Again, like right now I'm taking a break from people management, but...
I would take a break with people till you die.
Kind of realized I want to be the guy behind the people manager. I like the consultant type stuff.
Yes, exactly.
The MBA is very valuable for that too, but
I hear you. Boy, that's
it's tough stuff. I got a lot of respect for people that do it well.
Yeah. My world's a lot smaller now. Our business, we scaled back a lot of things that weren't producing income, and it's just a tighter thing now. And I never want to go back to the big
craziness of before.
Craziness of it.
Yeah.
My listeners know a lot of it is I came in as like a third generation pharmacist. So a lot of it was, even till now, even though my dad's been dead for 15 years, there was still like team members holding on that were hired by him and things like that. Maybe if I started fresh and I was like the CEO of some great idea I had and kind of looked upon with reverence and awe by my employees. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Although I don't know how many CEOs are looked at with awe
There's
and
no
reverence.
There's no chance in hell that happening. But so I don't think I'll ever be back.
It's almost like leaders are looked at with awe and reverence after they stop leading.
Yeah.
Everybody talks about Roosevelt and Churchill now. Who knows how many talked about them at the time? Probably they were controversial.
You look at someone like Bezos and Gates and stuff, and I think they stepped down in their late 50s from two important decisions so that their legacy has a chance to soften a bit, so they're not firing thousands of people like a day before they die kind of thing.
Now I'll have to wade into the political arena whether they like it or not. And no matter what they do, half the U.S. population will hate them for it.
Yeah.
it's a tough place to be. Yeah.
It's hard to be a leader, I guess. Yeah, even as president, no one has 100% rating. Alex, devil's advocate, your program is a business. Could I argue that don't bring more competition for yourself of writers into this, or is this like a huge field? And that's like saying don't make more pharmacists in the nation or something. I mean, is there any concern that you bringing in another 100 writers a year or whatever, that they say, hey, that guy might take my article chance away with this next place?
I don't know what the future market will hold, but right now it feels like I'm getting more work than I can take anyway. It's just a huge field and it's in really high demand. And so it's, and there's a lot of folks that want to get into it and just don't know how. So it's kind of connecting the dots. And I guess for me, I feel like I have 5 years of experience at this point and kind of getting into more like, more recently getting a job helping even with drug industry and kind of wading into the more traditional medical writing stuff. So feel pretty confident that I should be able to continue down that path, even if I help some others along the way.
Well, it never hurts. It always helps to be known as the leader, and certainly being able to teach in that area gives that to you too. It seems obvious that being a pharmacist and having an MBA maybe narrows the search for people that want an article written by that. If two people, you showed your information with these degrees and someone else just said, well, I just know this, I just write this way and I'm a good writer, and those are equal, do you have the leg up by having those degrees and so on?
By having the PharmD, yes, but not by having the MBA. PharmD and MD are probably some of the most in demand. And then PhD in like a life science, immunology or cell biology or something too. But for the clinical topics, yeah, PharmD and MD are probably the two most in demand degrees. And then after that point, the number one thing that companies are after is a portfolio. So in the beginning, you're going to have to send a lot of emails and applications and stuff, and then you land a few clients, and then it'll slowly build from there, and you'll get more of a portfolio and can start kind of extending your reach.
You mentioned like those five businesses that were driving you crazy last year. Touch on those. So one's going to be your writing, one's going to be your writing course and so on. What other ones are out there?
I think those were the kind of the ones that were actually, because the writing course I did over the period of maybe a week when I took a week off, and not even a full week, kind of like in a relaxed way. But yeah, the other one would definitely be my website, thefarmcompliance.com. I have more or less dropped it. It's still up. You can go there and hopefully you will like what I've already written since I've already done it. But I think I misread the demand from independent pharmacies to be able to just quickly download and inexpensively download tons of different forms and aids and stuff to save themselves a headache. Like, you could probably buy every form on my site for a little over $100. I don't know how many are on there. Maybe a little more, but it would save a big headache. But I think I just didn't quite understand that maybe the demand is there. I'm not quite sure where it went wrong in terms of the revenue, but it's been a year and it was a year and a half at the end of last year, and it still wasn't producing much revenue.
And that's your one that had the courses on fraud and compliance and those kind of things, right?
Yeah, and that was one of them because I was still writing regularly, trying to get that up and running. I got offered a job, a kind of a, not a job, but like a consultant arrangement where I was going to get a finder's fee, which is where you get a percentage for finding a deal on a patented temperature indicator. I thought the device was unique. I thought it would be an easy sell because it's actually a liquid. So you can match the thermal mass of the vaccine, for example. You can fill it with 10 milliliters of this patented liquid, and then it changes colors if it goes out of range. So it's like it accounts for the fact that one vial might be 10 mils and one might be 1 mil. And if they're at the same temperature, the 10 mil is going to be stable a little bit longer. That one I eventually dropped because I called everybody I knew. It felt like we had conversations with even drug industry.
And you were trying to find someone that would buy that patent?
Yeah, buy the patent out and then produce it. And it wasn't an enormous time commitment, but it's just that it was additive.
And it wasn't down your focus, really, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
It would have been a moneymaker, but maybe not down your focus.
Yeah, yeah. And then the last one was was actually another one that I didn't have any intention to get into either at the beginning of the year, but I met two Japanese pharmacists who were starting courses to help Japanese pharmacists learn to speak English.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so that seemed to be something that I might be able to help with. They each have thousands of people following them on Twitter, so it seemed like they had enough of an audience to bring in some revenue. And so we started with some live sessions, and then I pushed to produce an online course. But I've talked about this in other areas, but the biggest issue with that is the primary pharmacist that kind of founded it. Just don't think he was interested in making money off of it.
Mm.
And it didn't matter. It kind of felt like he felt like he was taking their money, even if he was giving them so much in return.
Felt guilty about it.
I don't feel like he had that business mindset to really turn it into a business. He even talked about turning it into a nonprofit at once, and kind of probably under the misleading aspect that maybe a nonprofit doesn't need revenue or something.
Yeah.
It just wasn't working out. It just, the business partnership was not working out. And then those are the things that I ended up kind of cutting off. Yeah.
What would be a cool week for you, like 10 years from now? You know, you wanted to bring income in. What would be the coolest way for you to do that? What would that week look like, basically, as far as, would it be all writing or this or that or what?
I think I'm a this or that kind of guy, but yeah. Yeah, but that's one of the reasons I like working at the hospital. But yeah, the medical writing, I could see being a big part of that. I love getting involved in a lot of areas of medical writing. Like I mentioned, the Chinese company I'm hoping eventually gets me the chance to see more of like the Chinese regulatory system, Chinese like culture and within healthcare and things. Like I've enjoyed that with Japan, seeing how pharmacy works in Japan.
You'd spend like all week thinking of the articles, writing the articles, researching the articles. You could do that full time, and that'd be a happy thing for you.
I think at least most of the week, yeah.
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 Yeah, that's cool.
So who knows, maybe I'll be one of those high class translators one day.
Taking trips, yeah.
Yeah.
This is an avenue for pharmacists that maybe like to write a little bit, pick up a little extra cash, and they might really enjoy this as a side thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. I enjoyed it for a long time just as a side thing with no intention to make it a career for a while until I realized it just kept working. And I tried everything I could last year to do something different.
Yeah.
And the medical writing is what worked. So not because I dislike it, I just was trying other things out. Medical writing has worked. And even my medical writing course has been by far the most successful of all those kind of business ideas I started last year. So I'm just going to roll with it.
How does someone take the first step in at least seeing your stuff? Where are they going to go to? Seeing your course, where are they going to go to?
They can go to Udemy through the link in the notes, or going to Udemy and find my course there.
How's that spelled out? U to me, or?
It's Udemy.
Oh.
.com. Yeah, where they have the online courses of.
What is it? UD?
Udemy.
Oh, Udemy. Is it a play on you to me, or is it, that's the name of it?
I guess I'm not really sure. I always thought it was Udemy until I heard somebody who worked for the company and someone, you know, probably some video on how to make your course or whatnot. I heard them pronounce it right.
That's why I can never do drugs on this course, because I can't even pronounce half of them anymore. So
you have to have Kim Newlove on here.
Yeah,
I
have to have Kim
something.
On here. Yeah. I was talking to Kim. I don't understand all those lines and stuff like that. I just ask someone else how it's done, and then I, you know, do it.
All those umlauts, yeah.
They're umlauts, not umlauts.
there you go.
You've been saying it wrong all this
time,
Alex. All right, Alex, it's been a pleasure. We'll be watching, and I'm sure a lot of people are going to get on that course because all the cool things we talked about that come from just writing itself, even if you're not quick to put money in your pocket with it, just the practice of writing is cool. So that's great stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Great stuff. And even if, you know, there's it's kind of like the digital nomad has become a trend, and I'm certainly one of the ones that's really attracted to that lifestyle, whether I'll ever be able to live it fully or not. So there's that whole group, and I'm sure there are listeners who are into that. That's one of the few, medical writing is one of the few ways you can use your pharmacy degree and be a digital nomad. So think about that. I mean, how many jobs out there could you, digital nomads working out of Bali or whatever, and you're still using your pharmacy degree, and you get to just kind of wander around. Assuming we're not in the era of COVID, of course, but in terms of job, yeah. So it's, I mean, what an opportunity.
I saw an ad. It was something like, I forget if it was before COVID or right afterwards, but it was something like, it was one of the Midwest, you know, plain states or something like Oklahoma. It's like Oklahoma, and their tagline was something like, "We have fast internet too," or something like
I've heard
that,
stuff
you know?
Like that. They're trying to attract those remote workers. Yeah,
there'll always be a room for the New York cities of the world and stuff like that. But some people just don't want to. They're not going to do that anymore. There's no reason to be in the city unless you love it.
Yeah, definitely.
At some point, but digital nomad. I like that. All right. Well, thanks, Alex. We'll be following closely.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. It's been a pleasure.
You too. Bye.
Thanks. Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.